Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Happy Saturday. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. Lots to get to today. We will talk about Evander Kane and his track suit. Blue Jays hold their State of the Franchise event down at Rogers Center, and it looks like, yes, that real grass thing might be happening for 2018. Also, the Raptors, the big win over the Clippers, and we'll get to some other stuff. Maybe Sebastian Giovinco arriving in Toronto. Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather might happen, and Julian Edelman and the perils of Tinder. All that coming up in the next couple of hours. But we start with a little history yesterday. Maple Leafs lose 4-1 to the New Jersey Devils, their franchise record 11th straight loss. This is a franchise that's been around for about 100 years, and they have never done what they are doing right now. Now, granted, they did pick up a point. There was one shootout loss to this very same Devils team during this 11-game span, but that's it. Everything else in regulation. Goals have not been there. They've actually done a fairly good job of limiting opponents' shots on goal, but the goaltending has not been good. And although it's hard to fault James Reimer yesterday, allowing those goals, and He gets knocked for four of them, even though one was into the empty net because he was still on the ice. But 34 shots on goal the Maple Leafs have, and the Devils, 17 shots for their four goals. And now we are seriously talking about Connor McDavid for this team. And the question I posed to you guys to start off the Maple Leaf conversation, if you're a Maple Leafs fan, you've been following and supporting this team your entire adult life, do you root for them to lose? Dave, do you root for them to lose?
Oh, I don't think there's any question you're rooting for them to lose. I mean, what's the alternative? You know, and we talk about it in sports all the time, you know, for any team, the worst place to be is in that kind of no man's land where you're out of the playoffs, but also not in kind of lottery contention. This team's clearly not fighting for a playoff spot. You know, all those numbers you just mentioned, they're clearly going the opposite direction. So, you know, the only hope if you're a Leafs fan is to lose every game from here on out and give yourself the best chance to get Connor McDavid.
Isn't it unseemly though, Gary?
I don't think so. I'm going to give you an indication of where Leaf fans are right now. I was watching the game at a local establishment last night, and Leaf fans were high-fiving each other when New Jersey would score their goals.
Like drinking a root beer or two?
Exactly, like ordering a round of shots for every New Jersey goal. I think, you know, I think it's at a point right now where there is no benefit to this team, you know, going 500 the rest of the season. I mean, they're quickly sliding down the standings. It seems unlikely they're going to get into those bottom two spots for a McDavid or an Eichel in the draft. But if you can get to that bottom three, four spots, it's a pretty deep draft, and it gives you a shot at getting a pick in those top two spots.
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say, and I mean, that's why games like last night and tonight are so important, you know, when you're facing those other teams you're in contention with for the bottom, right? New Jersey, Edmonton. So that was a clutch performance by Toronto last night.
They've done well in the must-lose games. They've lost to Carolina. They've lost to New Jersey a couple of times. They've lost to Arizona during this 11-game
I think we found
streak.
Out what this team is really good at.
Well, and I was among those that also was saying that top two is going to be so, so difficult because Edmonton, well, Buffalo is just, mm-hmm. I mean, they're so good at this tanking thing. But here we are, the Edmonton Oilers with a win in regulation tonight, and it's single digits in points that the Maple Leafs are within second overall as far as ping pong balls, and still about 30 games left to play in the regular season.
Sizable chunk of the season left here, yeah.
That's also what's kind of new about this. Well, first of all, we've never really seen a Maple Leafs team tank like this during a regular season. We've never seen it happen with a potential franchise-changing prospect up there at number one or number two, like this is the case. And yes, I know they finished out of the playoffs last couple of years, but it's been late season collapses where you've had no chance to throw stuff overboard at the trade deadline. This is happening early enough in the season, Gary, that you can do something about it. You can aid your chances to increase your draft draft a lottery ping pong ball situation.
And you know what? Here we are less than a month away from the NHL trade deadline. It'll be interesting to see what kind of moves they make. You imagine the Leafs are going to be sellers in this situation, but they've got a couple of big contracts that's going to be difficult to move. So, you know, I think the big question mark for this team is what happens with Cody Franson. I'm sure, you know, the Leafs probably won't go public with it, but I'm sure they'd love to move that Dion Phaneuf contract to be able to re-up a guy like Cody Franson. But, you know, who else you move ahead of the trade deadline? And then the next question is, if you're Brendan Shanahan, do you let Dave Nonis make those moves? Like, can we realistically think that Dave Nonis is going to be back next season running this team? If not, do you want him handling the moves ahead of NHL trade deadline? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. But, you know, back to what you were saying, Ben, you said this team's doing a really good job of tanking. And I think, you know, when you talk about the potential moves ahead, Gary, that's kind of where the tanking comes into play. Right now, I don't see a team that's tanking. I see a team that's just losing. And I think there is a difference. To tank, like, to me, it implies being proactive in helping your team in, put itself in a situation where it's going to lose.
They're doing a pretty good job of losing on their own, so maybe you don't want to mess with this tanking chemistry, right? Like, you don't
that's a good point.
And we talked just before we came on the air, you don't want to pull a Rudy Gay.
Exactly, yeah.
Think you're making a move to help with your tanking, all of a sudden it goes in the other direction. That's another thing. Luck plays into this a lot, right? Like, they outshot the Devils 34-17. Yes, puck luck is a bunch, is a big part of it. And, yes, it was going in their favor probably more than it should have early in the season. Everything they fired on net was seemingly going to the back of the net. That's why they were the highest scoring team in the National Hockey League, and people said it wouldn't last. I don't think anybody anticipated the type of month they had in January. It was unbelievable, and the number of shutouts this team and a number of one-goal games that they have had over the last month and a half, nobody could have anticipated that. But, I mean, it's hard to get away from the luck thing, right? We're talking about a team that has not won a cup since 67. There's not a, you know, to be out of the playoffs as often as they are, and to limit the opponents to just 17 shots on goal yesterday and to do a better job. That's another part of this. Peter Horacek has actually got this team limiting opponent shots on goal, and they continue to lose. I just don't know what to do with that information, except feel sorry for Peter Horacek, Gary.
You do have to feel for him. I mean, it's like they flipped a switch. I mean, the biggest issue under Randy Carlyle was that defensive game and how many shots they gave up a night. And, like, the second Horacek takes over, it just seems like they switch it just like that. But the offense has completely dried up. Like, you mentioned how few goals they've scored over this 11-game stretch. And even before that, like, it's an 11-game losing streak. And, you know, they won one before that, but they lost three or four prior to that. So you look at a guy like Phil Kessel. I mean, he's traditionally a streaky scorer. But, you know, he's got one goal over this 11-game stretch. Horrible time. You know, when your offense is drying up, this is not the time for your best goal scorer to also hit one of those downturns.
But I mean, you really chalk it up to bad luck. I mean, I think that can explain a few games here or there, but for this kind of a prolonged streak, I mean, that's a trend, you know? I mean, that's different than luck. I think they're proving that they're more than unlucky right now. They're just not good enough.
Well, there's been, I guess not every game is a 2-1 shot advantage for the Maple Leafs, but there are games during this 11-game stretch. They lost 4-3 in Ottawa to the Senators, outshooting the Sens 40-26. Yesterday, 34-17. They outshoot Philadelphia 30-18, lose 1-0. All right, there's more than one or two examples. There were winnable games during this 11-game stretch. And
no question.
Maybe it's, you know, part of the normalization of an 82-game regular season. We talked about how it seemed unsustainable when they were scoring 5 goals on 17 shots, getting outshot 52-23 early in the season, right? Maybe that is just an 82-game stretch, and eventually everything will regress to the mean. It's all coming down pretty quickly for this Maple Leafs team. And you know what? Maybe in a sense it is better that it's happening now when there is still time before the trade deadline to make those moves that are quote-unquote tank. Now, I'm one of the guys that doesn't necessarily agree with the North American professional sports model of drafting and draft lotteries and whatever, but this is the situation that we have. So the Maple Leafs, I guess, should embrace it. We talk about the fans wanting this team to keep losing. Do you heartily believe that Brendan Shanahan and this Maple Leafs brain trust is going to do whatever it takes, not bring in a Martin Gerber, but do whatever it takes to lose games down the stretch, Dave?
Yes. You know, I mean, I don't think...
What can they do?
That's the big question, you know?
Start breaking ankles with the tire iron.
Exactly,
or
but it's like we talked about before. It's about being proactive in setting yourself up in a certain position, you know, to ensure long-term success. And right now, that does mean, you know, maybe trading away some assets for draft picks. You know, we kind of saw that yesterday, I believe. Although I don't know if this conditional seventh round pick is really what we're talking about here. But you know, there are things you can do to make yourself even worse. And if you really want to commit to the idea of going for that number one pick, then I don't think you have a choice in doing that, right? But the flip side of it is, you know, you mentioned the lottery, and there are no guarantees whatsoever that things are going to work out for you. And I don't know if the average, you know, Leafs fan is going to be happy if it's anybody but McDavid. And there's a huge chance that it will be somebody not named Connor McDavid.
No, that's a very good point. But I mean, even if you're Brendan Shanahan, you're not even looking at it as a tank, really. I mean, you have to tell yourself, like, is the core of this team that you're building this team around, can this team be successful? And it doesn't look like it right now.
If you call it a rebuild, you know, it's a whole different animal,
So, I mean, you have to start looking at moving out these pieces to bring in pieces that are going to help you build to the future. So it's not really a tank if you're Brendan Shanahan. It's just changing the core of this team.
What am I missing here? Because I look at this team and I see pretty, you know, decent pieces. Nazem Kadri has actually taken a step forward in his development on both ends of the ice. You've got a guy in Phil Kessel who's a lock for 30 goals every single season, even with the dry spell right now. James Van Riemsdyk, a young guy who can put the puck in the back of the net. Morgan Rielly, a building block for the future on the back end. Jonathan Bernier, I know he's had a rough month and a half, but he's shown that, you know, at times he can put a team on his back. Peter Holland, maybe there's something there. Should this team be as bad as it is? Should it be a bottom two team in the National Hockey League?
There's no question that they're underachieving right now because we've seen this group do a lot better, right? So, I mean, that, I think there's no question they could be doing better than they are. But at some point, you know, you see the production on the ice and you say, you know, at what point do you say we just have to move on from this? It's not working.
Ben, I found it interesting. You didn't mention Dion Phaneuf as part of that core. Did you just forget his name, or?
Well, he's injured right now.
That's true.
And you know what?
And that's part of the luck too, by the way.
Yes. What? That he's injured right now.
Having guys go down, you know, I don't know how much he was providing to begin with, but you know, he's they're better with him on the ice than off it. I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, Gary, you bring up an interesting point because I think when it comes to, well, first of all, Phaneuf is maybe the most polarizing Maple Leaf on this team, and he wears the captain, so naturally he is going to draw a lot of scrutiny.
He might be the most polarizing in the league.
It's very, very possible. He is out with the injury, maybe returning tonight against the Oilers on Hockey Night in Canada down at the Air Canada Center. But when I mentioned those players who have seemingly, you know, reasonable skill sets, and maybe even in the case of an Nazem Kadri or a Morgan Rielly, further along to go and could get even better, part of it is also outside of skill. And it's hard to say that because I'm one of those people who watches sports now through the lens of analytics, almost every sport. Not entirely, but there is a big part of that to viewing sports now. You can't watch sports really and not think about analytics. But there is still the human element to it. And there's something to be said about teams that have a lack of chemistry or something not quite right in the dressing room. And we talk about the big number on Dion Phaneuf's contract, and yes, that's a big part of it. But how much of that chemistry, that intangible thing, which I hate saying, but how much of that changes if somehow this team is able to move on from a guy who is so polarizing like Dion Phaneuf? Gary?
I mean, that's a good question. You know, we talk about, you know, teams taking on the personality of their captains and their coaches, you know, whoever the leader is in the dressing room. And, you know, you go earlier in the season, the whole stick gate, the salute gate situation where they fail. You know, Dion Phaneuf, from what we know, Dion Phaneuf and Phil Kessel are driving that bus.
Yeah.
So I think that says a lot about, you know, where his leadership is or whether or not he's capable of leading this team to where they need to go.
I mean, I think you just look at how a team responds to adversity, you know, and I think it always comes back to leadership and the way the Leafs have been playing lately, you know, the way they've responded to this losing streak doesn't look like they're ready to snap out of it anytime soon. Last night, you mentioned, you know, it did seem like a bit of an improvement, but still get the loss. So, you know, I think that speaks volumes too in terms of, you know, how you go about turning things around or if you do at all. And with the Leafs, they're not.
I look at the highlights. I was doing Sportsnet Central last night and had Maple Leafs highlight back. And I just, every time they show Peter Horacek, my heart breaks just a little bit for the guy. Don't you feel sorry for a guy who's
a tough spot?
You know, he's a hockey lifer. He's getting an opportunity here with one of the marquee franchises in the National Hockey League. And I almost say no fault of his own, but I guess some of it has to come down on the head coach. The offense has just completely dried up. And I was I wasn't so sure that it was all Randy Carlyle's fault that they were getting outshot 45-15 seemingly every single game. But you really, you look at the numbers, shots on goal-wise, he has made a huge difference in limiting those. And I wonder, is this brain trust going to be discouraged by the results that they've had in limiting the attempts? Because this team was pretty good scoring on the rush, although they weren't the last few games of the Randy Carlyle regime, but early in the season and throughout his tenure, they could at least score, and they can't do that anymore. It was fun. They were losing 6-5. That was fun. Yeah. Sure, a lot more fun than 1-0, which they've done a whole bunch recently, Dave.
And that seemed a lot more suited to the players on the team, you know, that style, that up-tempo, you know, kind of higher octane than what we've seen lately. But, you know, in sports, it's always the coach that goes first, right? And it's not, and it's, I don't want to say rarely, but it's definitely not always the coach's fault for whatever problem is happening. So, you know, I think maybe we're seeing that with Carlyle now with his firing. Team hasn't responded. I mean, they haven't in those ways you're talking about in terms of, like, the analytics and the way the numbers show it. But obviously the team's not responding to the coaching change. So maybe, you know, maybe it didn't have to do with the coach in the first place.
Well, it's funny when you say that this team was better suited to playing that style, considering that style was no defensive responsibilities. That's probably not a good thing.
Yes, not so good at all. I mentioned yesterday that the Devils score those four goals on just 17 shots. And that's, as much as the offense has dried out, and that's probably the number one story over this, not just 11-game stretch, but, you know, month and a half, 2 months now, and entire season, the goaltending can't be glossed over because it has not been good either. And again, I don't know how much I could fault James Reimer on individual goals. There was a bad luck one, bounces off the end boards, and then shot goes off his leg and in. But Jonathan Bernier, during the month of January, had a save percentage under 900. Does this team now... You add all the question marks, Dion Phaneuf, what they do with, you know, that top line. How do they rebuild this team? Can you put goaltender now on that list of question marks going forward, Gary?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Jonathan Bernier's proved that he's a very capable goaltender. It's been a bad stretch, but I mean, it's been a bad stretch for the team. The one bizarre element to his poor play is the fact that they have reduced the number of shots he's facing. He's probably used to facing 40 pucks a night. He's not used to seeing only 15 to 20, and it's throwing his game off a little bit.
That explains it.
But I do think he is the number one goaltender for this team moving forward. I don't think that's an area they need to address in the short term.
I don't know. I mean, I think when a team's doing this poorly, I don't think anybody's safe. You know, I think you're doing whatever, any opportunity that comes up to get better, you take advantage of it. You don't have anybody locked in any position. You know, there's very few positives to take from this team right now at any position, including goaltender.
Is there, because at a certain point, I want to talk about the watchability of this team. At a certain point, you know, you lose a couple in a row and you're, you know, win one, lose four, win one, lose another three. Like, that's meh. Now, all of a sudden, it gets into the realm of the schadenfreude, into the realm of the bizarre. I think tonight is almost must-watch television, CBC, Hockey Night in Canada, the McDavid Derby between the Maple Leafs and the Edmonton Oilers, Dave.
Totally. And I mean, my thing with sports is I want to be watching history. You know, it's why I like dynasties. You know, it's why I don't have a problem when the same team keeps winning. I want to watch history. And it works the other way around, too. I want to watch historically bad teams, historically good teams. I want to be able to say I was there when the Leafs set their futility record. You know, it would be maybe more fun if it was a winning record. I don't know. But I like watching, you know, history unfold in front of us. And that's what's happening tonight.
Plus, you can actually, you know, root for the Oilers. Like, that's... If you're a Maple Leafs fan, you are no question rooting for the Oilers. And I get it. The fans in Edmonton probably aren't rooting for losses at this point because they've seen it over the last 5 years. But the Maple Leafs, you know, it's been very rare that you've been able to do this so early in the season over the last decade or so, Gary.
Yeah, I mean, the closest you can think of is the year they made the trade with Boston, sending, two firsts and a second to, you know, for Phil Kessel, and then they end up sliding so far down the standings and getting the second overall pick. So, I mean, they didn't foresee that happening. But you're right, it's still a long way to go, and they're sliding fast.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, okay, you mentioned watchability. I don't want to go off topic too much, but, you know, this is a debate I was having with some buddies of mine. Not even a debate, just a kind of interesting point. You know, and you also mentioned the derby. So in soccer, they have the delegation and relegation system set up, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that I think would be really interesting in North American sports because it would create a situation where almost every season, you know, you have a reason to be watching. You know, maybe if you're not in the draft lottery, maybe you're watching, you know, whether or not your team's going to be delegated right now, you know, and it just gives you something more to watch for. So maybe NHL is talking about realignment. Maybe let's take it one step further. Delegate some teams. Yeah, relegate some teams.
Yeah, I'm sure MLSC would be ecstatic to watch Maple Leafs play a year in the AHL, Gary. Yeah, I'm sure that'll work, right?
Well, it looks like an AHL team right now. So.
Yeah. That's incentive to win.
Yeah, no question about it. Before we move on to Evander Kane, I mentioned the luck and the fact that they are now bucking the trend in the opposite direction because they're out shooting teams by 2-1 margins and losing 4-1. Couldn't you see the whole thing flipping around and them totally screwing up their draft position by going on a run here in the final 30 games? Like that would be so Leafs.
You mentioned it. It's the Rudy Gay trade. You know, the Masai Ujiri is pretty open about the fact that that was not a trade meant to make his team better. You know, it was done with the future in mind. But you bring in these kind of, I don't want to say scrubs, but these guys who were previously, you know, not major players in the NBA, and they helped turn the team around. That could happen with the Leafs, you know, addition by subtraction.
Exactly. That's a massive fear. I mean, like you mentioned Martin Gerber earlier, make sure that Dave Nonis doesn't have his phone number in the Rolodex because that's the last thing this team needs right now.
Absolutely. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Annis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. The Winnipeg Jets now have shut down Evander Kane for the rest of the season, or he's done it to himself. Yeah. He's decided to have season-ending shoulder surgery, had just the 22 points in 37 games this season. Of course, things coming to a head the other day with him pulling himself, apparently, from the lineup in that game in Vancouver, his hometown, against the Canucks, and it seemingly stemmed from him showing up at a team event wearing a tracksuit, which he wasn't supposed to do. Dustin Byfuglien's a big boy, and he didn't take too kindly to it, threw it in the shower, and Evander Kane wasn't too pleased about that and apparently went off sulking off to his hotel room or whatever and decided, you know what, not going to show up for the game. We've heard this throughout his career. I mean, it's not just in the National Hockey League as well. I mean, he's had a rap going back to his Giants days as well. Is he untouchable as far as somebody swooping in and grabbing him? What kind of a return can you expect to get if you're the Winnipeg Jets for a guy who is, you know, just 23 years old as well? Let's not forget, scored 30 goals in 2011-2012, Gary.
I think he still has great value. I mean, there's always a team or a GM out there that thinks they can, you know, change a player around, turn him around, and, you know, thinks he needs a new change of scenery. And, I mean, he's a super talented player, and he's had some issues there in Winnipeg. But, you know, it's very similar to the Tyler Seguin situation. Like, Boston wasn't happy with some of his off-ice stuff and some of, you know, the things he was doing in the dressing room. And, you know, another team stepped up and gave him a decent package for him. And you look at Tiger Seguin, what he's done in Dallas, and he's, you know, he's a fantastic player.
You know, I'm with you that there is value for a guy like Kane, and it is one of those systems where you put him on a team with the right kind of leadership, the right kind of coach, and, you know, maybe whatever issues he had in Winnipeg are a non-issue in his new on a new team. But in terms of his trade value, I mean, it's kind of frustrating if you're the Winnipeg Jets right now, because where he is now, you know, he's had a down year, you know, from the 30-goal score we've seen in the past. So, I mean, I think this season has really hurt his value considerably on the trade market. If you look at where, you know, what they could have gotten for a guy like Kane before the season started versus now, I think it's wildly different. And it's probably in their best interest to move him if he's not going to be playing for them. He's going to be calling sick out of games, basically.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you're going to get equal value in terms of what his potential is for your team. You might not have a choice if you're Winnipeg, but I think his value is pretty down right now.
I mean, you certainly won't get as much as if he was playing well and played a full season and was getting along fine with his teammates, but I still think a team will, you know, you can still dangle a couple of pieces in front of Winnipeg. They'll get a decent package for him, and I don't think there's any way he's back in Winnipeg next season.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say, but I mean, even when he was playing this year, it wasn't the same guy we were seeing. I mean, I don't know how much that has to do with the injuries. You know, his agent was saying he's been playing hurt for a while. Right. I don't know how much weight you put into that, but we've seen a different Evander Kane this season, even before this happened.
And don't forget, this is also happening kind of at a crisis point for the Winnipeg Jets as well. Still kind of firmly in that playoff position, 7 points up on the Colorado Avalanche, but they've lost six straight. They haven't won since the All-Star break, right?
I mean, the interesting thing to me is that through all of this, it seems pretty clear who's at fault, for lack of a better word. I mean, when I hear about Byfuglien throwing the tracksuit in the shower, I mean, that sounds ridiculous to me. But in the wake of that, not one person has said, you know, they've all come in defense of Bufflin. They've all, you know, kind of, I don't want to say thrown Kane under the bus because I think he threw himself under the bus. But, you know, no one's coming out to support Kane in this. You know, I think it's very clearly that line has been drawn. I think, you know, his days in Winnipeg are done. I think it's such a clear kind of black and white situation here.
And clearly, Bufflin carries some weight in that dressing room.
So. Yeah.
Yes, he does. Wow. Shots fired, Gary Mello. So right now, Winnipeg Jets need some wins. Probably help everything going forward, including getting this bad taste left by Evander Kane out of their mouths and Paul Maurice able to move forward. And now, at least, with Kane going under the knife, he's not going to have to answer questions about it anymore as well, which helps, I guess.
So, back to what we were talking about before, being proactive and tanking. If you're the Maple Leafs right now, how about trading for a guy with a lot of potential who won't be playing for you at all this season?
Well, but I mean, you go along that line, we talk about team chemistry. Is that the type of guy you want to bring into that locker room, Gary?
I mean, it would certainly fit in well to the tank mode, right? Like, if you trade a guy like Joffrey Lupul to Winnipeg for an Evander Kane, then you're taking a roster piece off your current team, and you're bringing in a young player who's not going to play for the rest of the season. So it would certainly play into that. I just don't think Evander Kane's the right fit here in Toronto because you don't have that veteran voice. Now, we talk about Dion Phaneuf and the questions around his leadership. Like, if you got a Jonathan Toews in the locker room, it's a little bit easier to bring in a player like Evander Kane, who Jonathan Toews can kind of grab him by the neck, pull him aside, and kind of set him straight. I'm not sure you have that in Toronto.
It seems that there's not a whole lot of that going around. Not a ton of leaders out there as well to just go out and grab at the trade deadline. When we come back, Blue Jays holding their State of the Franchise event last week at Rogers Centre. There is some new field turf down there, and in 2018 they are hoping to have real grass. Also, maybe an All-Star game in this fair city in the coming years, with pitchers and catchers reporting in just a couple of weeks as well. I know it's hard to believe with the weather we've had recently. What are the big storylines headed into spring training for this Blue Jays team? Aaron Sanchez, bullpen, or starting rotation? We'll discuss all of that and plenty more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. The Toronto Blue Jays holding their State of the Franchise event this past week at Rogers Centre. Paul Beeston was there, got a standing ovation. There were a couple guys that booed, and everybody gets booed. We get booed walking into this building, right?
Right.
They're booing us on the other side of the glass. But he was there. They took questions. They shed some light on a few things. We'll get to the team and their prospects for this upcoming season and maybe previewing spring training and pitchers and catchers reporting at the end of this month. But what, I don't know, for some reason I can't get over this grass thing at Rogers Centre. I'm so excited for the possibility. I think it'll change the fan experience so much at Rogers Centre. I would love to see a new ballpark in this city, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, even though Rogers Centre is seemingly pretty dated and one of the now older ballparks in all of Major League Baseball, which is hard to believe. But you get some real grass in there. I think it will change things significantly, and it looks like we are now back on track because there were some question marks and some stuff written over the last couple of months about problems that they were having and not finalizing their agreement with the University of Guelph. Now, apparently that has happened. Paul Beeston said they've signed an agreement with the University of Guelph to study the feasibility and try and figure out what strain of grass and try and figure out how much they have to dig up and how they can do it and can they do it in one off season, because that's all important. But 2018 is now the target for real grass at Rogers Centre. Gary, does that change things for you? I mean, I don't know how many Blue Jays games you attend, but would you be more apt to go down to Rogers Centre if it was real grass?
I mean, I got my flex back. I've had that for a few years, so I go down quite a bit to the ballpark every year for sure. I think it does change things. I mean, not only in the way the game plays, but I think players are more likely to consider Toronto if there is a grass field in there. I mean, you look at injuries and you know, free agents being concerned about signing in a place that, because now there's only, is it two places, I believe, in all the majors that have the turf?
Yeah, they're in Tropicana Field. That's
exactly.
It.
So, I mean, that's, if you're a free agent, you know, there's 28 other options that give you a better playing surface. So that, I think it has hurt the Blue Jays. So I don't think they can get in there fast enough.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it makes a huge impact in terms of fan attendance and whatnot, in terms of the game experience. It will look a little bit better, sure, but you still have the concrete around you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of the newer.
I don't know. I take a little bit of issue with that, though, Dave. Like, you get that place packed in the middle of summer with the roof open and the sun shining down, 50,000 mm-hmm. fans in there, which is, you know, it does happen. In fact, you know, they've had some pretty good crowds the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. It's not the worst ballpark in the major leagues.
I never said it was. I'm talking strictly like turf versus grass,
yeah,
you know.
Okay. You mentioned the concrete.
Yeah, well, it's there, you know.
It is made of concrete,
to break
I guess.
It to you. Yeah,
you
know, the building's made of concrete.
The concrete doesn't help because it is a cavernous building if you don't have a full house.
Right.
I mean, like, as you mentioned, when there's 50,000 people in there, it helps tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, you pack it in, it's a great experience. When it's empty, it really feels empty. Yeah. The real grass will make a difference in terms of the aesthetics, I suppose. But like Gary's saying, the biggest difference is going to come in the way, in perceptions of the stadium, perceptions of what it means to play on the Blue Jays. You know, that turf is a deterrence. So to get rid of that, you know, it can only be a good thing.
Also, what apparently is key in all of this, I've learned more about grass than I ever thought I would know last few months reading up on this. And every time I see a story about it, I can't pull my eyes away. But apparently a big part of it is airflow. It's not just, you know, getting the right UV lights to grow the grass. It's actually getting the air flowing through there. Because even when the roof is open at that place, you don't ever really feel a breeze because it's, you know, there's walls surrounding you all around. So to get an open air feel, get some sort of airflow in there would help. I don't know how you do that, but like knock down part of the stadium or something. Like
there you go.
Make half of the stadium retract down. I don't know.
I think that's
change everything.
That's a pretty sensible solution, I think.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not an engineer. Maybe you took some engineering classes in college, but yeah, I don't know.
Careful. R.A. Dickey doesn't want too much wind in that place.
So. Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Keep those walls up.
So maybe they'll keep those walls up when he's pitching. I think the bigger issue, though, with Rogers Center, we got to get some craft beers back in there because it's sad when Comerica Park in Detroit has a better selection of Toronto craft beers than Rogers Center. So mentioned Paul Beeston was there at the State of the Franchise taking some questions. One of the questions was about the All-Star Game, and it's been a long time since the Major League Baseball All-Star Game was here in Toronto. You have to go back to the early 90s. He says it's a discussion that has happened between him and new Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred, and we see it very often. New ballparks get the All-Star Game.
It's a showcase for them.
Yeah, for sure. We saw it with Citi Field. We saw it with Yankee Stadium. When those were completed, soon after, they were given All-Star Games. Mentioned that Rogers Center is one of the oldest buildings in all of the major leagues, but if you did, you know, put some grass in there, added that new feature to this ballpark, could we see the All-Star Game back in Toronto, Gary?
That's tough. I mean, you mentioned all the nice ballparks. I mean, they're going to Cincinnati this year, San Diego the year after that. So, I mean, I have a hard time seeing how high up on the list Toronto would be with the Rogers Center.
They do like to do that. They like to reward teams, though, and showcase ballparks. I think there's a legitimate possibility, and it has been so long. I mean, there's only 30 ballparks you can put it in, right?
And you know, the one thing I will say for the Rogers Center, I mean, I think it gets a lot of negative, you know, criticism here in the city. But whenever I'm down, I'm talking to fans who are up from Boston or New York or Chicago. They all still seem to love the ballpark. Like they still love coming up to Toronto to the games, and they still say you've got a great ballpark. So I think it's more of a Toronto thing than it is the perception outside across the majors. So.
Well, and I think what a lot of people forget is, in April when it's, you know, 5 degrees outside, they're playing baseball indoors. When it's raining, they're still playing baseball.
Yeah.
And if you're making the trip from New York or Boston, you don't have to worry about your whole weekend getting rained out, right? If you're making the trip to watch a couple of games in Toronto, you know you're going to see those games.
Well, that's an interesting point because I'm thinking about the fact that it is an indoor stadium that can open. And I wonder, first of all, I don't know if this is true, and I don't know exactly how it's going to work when you get real grass in there, but it might very well be the case that when they get real grass in there because of the airflow thing, because of the UV and whatever, that it is an open-air stadium that can close. Does that change things for you? If in April and it's 10 degrees, 5 degrees, it's a cool day, mm-hmm. it's drizzly, They got to keep that thing open. Does that keep you away from the ballpark, or do you like the elements?
I mean, I think you can make an argument for both sides there. I mean, I think, you know, it's fun when you see the fans in stadiums, in those cold weather stadiums, the open air stadiums, to see them kind of persevere through the game. It almost like makes a win that much more worthwhile. You know, it makes it feel better. But I think, you know, going back to your All-Star question, I think Toronto is a good destination for that kind of thing, just because of what the city offers. You know, right. I think that makes it an attractive destination. We're going to see it next year with the NBA All-Star game. You know, it's a good place to bring in huge groups of people. You know, there's good infrastructure for that. Maybe not on the roads, but that's another discussion.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot that Toronto has to offer for those kind of big events. And I think, you know, that maybe coupled with the grass would be a factor for the MLB wanting to bring the game here.
Yeah, I think everybody looking forward to that NBA All-Star game in White Vegas, as it has been referred to a number of times. Charles Barkley, listening to the TNT broadcast on Thursday, was bigging up the All-Star game in Toronto coming up. Also, Jays-wise at the State of the Franchise, of course, talking about the issues still concerning this team. I'm surprised they haven't made more moves to bolster a bullpen that or at least was pretty weak last year, and maybe a big reason why they finished on the outside of the playoffs looking in. And a big part of the outlook for the bullpen going forward is, where does Aaron Sanchez slot in there? Because if he's in the bullpen, I think we agree he's going to be good, because he was good last year, unless, of course, he slumps. But and bullpens can be very up and down. If you had your druthers, Aaron Sanchez, with how good he looked coming out of the bullpen a year ago, you had to make a decision whether you put him in that fifth starter spot or you put him in the bullpen as your closer, which now he has experience doing. Dave, where would you put him?
You know, it's a tough spot, because when you look at the starting five, the rotation for the Jays right now, you're banking on production from Stroman, who is, you know, has 130 innings under his belt. I think he's going to be really good, but you know, you never know with the young players. You're assuming that R.A. Dickey and Mark Burley are both kind of going to be ageless, and I think those are the two biggest variables in that rotation. Maybe Daniel Norris is a guy who can contribute. Hutchison is going to contribute, but he came back from that surgery last year at least. So I don't think there's guarantees in the rotation. The bullpen is the area that you look at as a bigger question mark. But if you're going to be in a situation where you think you need help in the rotation, Sanchez is a perfect kind of fit for that, I think. And when you couple with the fact that there are closers out there still in the market, it's just that the Jays maybe don't want to spend the money to get them. But a guy like Rafael Soriano or K-Rod, Francisco Rodriguez, those guys are out there. So there are options for your closer spot that maybe in the long term, it's more worthwhile to get Sanchez in your rotation because of that, because you don't need him in that closer spot. But as the team's currently constructed, I think Sanchez is the closer. I think he's the guy who you need in that spot.
I think the one wild card in this is, you mentioned Daniel Norris. I think if he, you know, you get a good look at him in spring training, I think if he can win that fifth spot, it makes it a lot easier to move Sanchez to the bullpen.
Do you think it's going to be between Sanchez and Norris in spring training for that fifth spot?
I mean, Estrada will probably also come into play,
course,
in that
yeah.
conversation. So I think, you know, but if Daniel Norris can kind of win that fifth spot and you move Sanchez to the bullpen, I can't see the Blue Jays spending money to try to bring in a closer or bullpen help. I mean, you know, bullpens are notoriously unpredictable.
Yeah.
Like
yes.
Alex
yeah.
said it himself, you know, it's the toughest part of your team to evaluate. So if you move Sanchez to the bullpen, I think that's already a huge help. And if you look at this team, like in 2013, coming into the season, you know, everyone was concerned about the, but going into the season, no one expected that. Like, it was the biggest concern on the team, and they had it was probably their strength in 2013. And then last year, with a lot of the same personnel coming back, it was a weakness. It was a huge weakness on the team. I mean, Delabar went from like an all-star to the minors.
Triple A.
You know what I mean? So that goes to tell you how tough it is to kind of gauge that.
Bullpens are almost, they're kind of like New England Patriots running backs. You know, it's interchangeable. But you know, you brought up Marco Estrada, and that's a huge name that I left out. I mean, I think he's a really good pitcher. I think he's really going to contribute this season. That was a nice little pickup, and maybe that does solve your fifth spot, or it lets you allow for Stroman to keep developing, or Burley or Dickey to fall off, and for the team not to suffer as a result.
And let's face it, you're not going to go a whole season with only five starting pitchers. Chances are,
yeah.
if you start the season with Estrada as your fifth starter, Norris is probably going to get some starts along the way.
Right,
of
and
course.
It could add a little intrigue here into spring training as well, if they do have an open competition for that fifth starter spot. The beginning of the season is going to be interesting, because remember a couple of years ago when there was all the excitement about the trade with the Miami Marlins, all the big names coming over, and Blue Jays being the odds-on Vegas favorites to win the World Series.
Wow.
You gotta help us, a couple of years ago. And they got off to that absolutely rancid start. People forget, though, there was a moment in that season where they had won 11 straight, and, you know, Munenori Kawasaki was hitting walk-offs. It was really thrilling, and it looked like they were going to get back into it, and then it all fell off the cliff again. But this is, we all understand, I think, a huge year for everybody in that front office, because Alex Anthopoulos' deal comes to an end. Paul Beeston's going to be gone at the end of this season. John Gibbons gets a new year added to his contract every New Year's Day, so they're going to have to pay him out if they fire him either way. But that is still a card to play at some point if the Blue Jays get off to a rough start, maybe bringing in a new manager. Is there a tipping point, Gary, where do you think Alex Anthopoulos says, okay, you know, there are teams that sometimes they fire their manager, bring somebody new in, and it kickstarts them. If we are, you know, such and such a games back out of first at this point in the season, that's a move I will make.
That's a great question. I cannot see Alex firing Gibbons. I think those two are probably in it together. And then you mentioned Beeston, his final season with the Blue Jays. I can't see him firing Anthopoulos. So I got a feeling the three of them are probably around for the probably the entire 2015 season.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Alex Anthopoulos cutting bait on his buddy if he's going to be gone either way, but I don't know, might be something we see.
And we were just talking about it earlier with the Leafs. I mean, firing your coach, firing your manager, it doesn't always make a difference.
And sometimes often, it does, though.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, I don't know. I guess you got to wait and see with that kind of situation, take that risk. I don't know if that's the answer, you know, if the Jays are struggling. I mean, if it's something that was brought up last year during the season, I don't really think it was the answer then, you know. I don't know. I don't know how much of a difference a manager makes in terms of that in baseball in particular.
Yeah, it's there's very few Joe Maddens out there, and yeah, we'll see how much of an impact Joe Madden has both in Chicago and what his absence means in Tampa Bay with that Rays team, who is, yeah, they are kind of in a different mode, though, this year, I think. Not quite a rebuild, but different expectations for the Tampa Bay Rays. When we come back, the Raptors go down pretty big early to the Clippers yesterday at home and come back in a big way. They were down 15 after one, end up winning 123-107. James Johnson makes his return. He's good. But what do we think about the Raptors fans booing this team in that first quarter after that slow start? It's a team that is now 34-17 and still second in the Eastern Conference. And of course, I can't talk about the Raptors without talking about Jonas Valanciunas and his deployment late. We'll discuss all that and plenty more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. Raptors dig themselves an early first quarter hole yesterday at Air Canada Center against the Clippers. Trail by 15 after 1, 34-19. Eventually come all the way back and they win it 123-107 to improve to a 34-17, and that is actually better than the Clippers 33-18 mark. And Raptors sweep the season series, beat the Clippers at Staples Center, beat them here in Toronto, and the Clippers back-to-back embarrassing losses against Eastern Conference opponents because they were smoked by the Cavaliers on Thursday night as well. But what caught my, I was going to say I, but you hear sounds. What caught my ear early in the first quarter was, and I don't know if this is an indictment of Toronto fans, but it made me uncomfortable that the Raptors were met with a smattering of boos after that first quarter in which they departed trailing by 15. This team is still second in the Eastern Conference, Gary, but To boo them, I know it wasn't the greatest performance, and you know what? This team has had rough first quarters all season long, but what did you make of booing this team at any point on home court this season?
You know what? They were losing big. They were giving up a lot of shots. I think the fans just thought they were at a Leafs game. I think that's right. They probably just mixed up who was playing on the court.
They looked up at the banners.
Yeah, I think that just probably is it's more of an indication of where the temperature is with this fan base, and you know, for the sports fan in this city,
yeah,
kind of thing.
You think of Raptors fans as being the, you know, the exception to the Toronto sporting rule, that they actually have optimism, that they cheer to get a team going instead of, you know, the negative reinforcement, yeah, you see around this city?
They do, but I mean, there's so many twists and turns in an NBA season. I mean, they reeled off six straight wins and lost those two games, you know, last week. So it's kind of, you start to worry a little bit when you drop two games against teams you probably should be beating. And then, you know, you come out and you're down 15 at the end of the first quarter. I can understand the, you know, I don't suggest booing, but I can understand the fear because as a Toronto sports fan, you're always waiting for the wheels to fall off.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there. It's, you know, coming off that Brooklyn loss, that Milwaukee loss, there was some genuine concern on the part of fans in terms of, you know, what's happening to our season, you know, what's happening to our team. So to see them come out with another poor start like that, it just looked like it was like deja vu all over again and frustration set in. Part of it, I think, is that, you know, Raptors fans don't really know how to deal with situations like this, like cheering for a really good team.
You know, it's new. It's all new.
It's fairly new territory. It is. So, I mean, you have your highs and lows. It's a learning process for everybody, fans included.
It really has been kind of an up and down couple of weeks as well, because mm-hmm. it went out west and it started well, that road trip, and you know, they picked up wins in L.A. against the Clippers, and they picked up that win in Denver against the Nuggets back-to-back.
Even the losses there, like the Portland loss comes to mind. I mean, that was a hard-fought game. You walk away from that thinking positively.
Yeah, but they do lose that game, absolutely, in a game they could have won in overtime. Yeah. But then the wheels kind of fell off for a week and a half, couple mm-hmm. of weeks. Golden State was not good. Phoenix wasn't good. Came back home, disappointing loss to Charlotte. Barely beat Boston. Lost to the Pistons.
And then when they did start winning games, it was against horrible clubs. So you
Philly.
Know,
yeah. And then they
Philly,
played...
Philly, Boston.
They played a whole bunch of sub-500 teams there. They played six straight, won them all.
Yeah.
Or five straight, won them all. And then...
Six of seven, yeah.
Played that that game in Washington that we all thought was kind of their first statement game in a while. Blew a big lead late in that one, but eventually, you know, showed a little bit of mettle and won that one overtime.
Which I think was a statement to itself. You know, the game before that, too, was in Brooklyn, that overtime right. game where they blew another lead. And I know a lot of people thought, you know, it was obviously the Raptors are at fault for blowing the lead, but I took that away as, you know, a team that's able to kind of persevere and step up in those OT situations. So, yeah, really rocky for the past few weeks. And then it culminates in that first quarter last night.
Yeah, it was a great second half for the Raptors.
Yeah.
And the three ball was a big reason why they were so good yesterday, where they were 13 of 30 from beyond the arc, 43% shooting from out there. And I know it's easy to say the Raptors live and die by the three, Dave, but has that just become a thing in the NBA? It's almost like every team lives and dies by the three.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, you brought it up before in terms of how sports are kind of guided by analytics now more than ever, and I think that's just part of it. You know, the analytics community is very vocal in terms of saying that threes are worth more than twos, you know, which is a very uncontroversial statement. And so as a result, you're seeing a ton more NBA teams tailor their offense towards a three-point shot, and I don't think the Raptors are any different in that regard.
And, you know, not to get too much off topic with the Raptors, but we look at the game last night between the top team in the West and the top team in the East, like
yes.
the Atlanta Hawks beat the Warriors
yeah.
with the three ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Both of those teams shoot it so well.
Best teams in their respective conferences, and they live and die by the three.
Like a 124-116 final in a game that was only played in four quarters. Like, that's yep. a pretty exciting game.
Who's not signing up for that NBA final right now, right? Like, that would be great.
And who would have called that heading into the season?
Neither team has won a division title in the last 20 years. And
wow.
And here they are, the most anticipated game of the season and living up to expectations.
And also, those are two teams where like you put your kid in front of the TV and you say, like, watch how these two teams go about their business. This is what sports is about. This is what basketball is about. You know, really like team-oriented performances, you know, everyone playing for each other selflessly. So, yeah, that would be a tremendous matchup.
And there are also two teams that the Raptors will be facing this month. So you talk
yes,
about,
yeah.
I mean, the Raptors, if they're struggling with their defense, they need to get that together quick, because you look at their upcoming schedule. I mean, you got two tough games at home, tomorrow at San Antonio, Washington later this week. Then you go on a road trip with Atlanta, Houston, New Orleans, and Dallas. And after that, you're relieved to come home and you get Golden State.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any easier.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't. And, well, a lot of people looked at this stretch even before the All-Star break, Clippers and Spurs, and thought, man, well, you lose back-to-back Milwaukee, Brooklyn, you could be looking at a four-game losing streak headed into the All-Star break, or five-gamer.
But hey, listen, James Johnson is back, so no problem. Bring on Golden State, bring on all these teams, right, the way he was playing last night.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because James Johnson's kind of been one of the surprise performers this season when healthy, and then all of a sudden he fell out of the rotation with the return of DeMar DeRozan and the insertion of Greivis Vásquez into the starting rotation, and I guess the demotion of Terrence Ross was, mm-hmm. I guess, the key contributing factor there, Dave. And I know you've spent some time around this team recently at practice and having conversations with them. is he now a part of that rotation, and is it now coming at the expense of Tyler Hansbrough? He only played 2 minutes yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, someone's not going to be able to play because it is still a deep team, and if James Johnson's going to come in and take those forward minutes, someone's going to see the bench, and it's going to be Hansbrough, Chuck Hayes, those guys. I think
the ultimate way to be able to visualize.
I think that the way he played last night, I think it's going to be indicative of how the Casey's going to use him in the future. You know, I think when you come in and I think he was 7 for 7 from the floor, he was guarding Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, just kind of, hey, his fingerprints were all over that game. I think it's really going to make a big difference in how much we see him on the court. You know, he's forcing the issue for Casey right now.
Like, that says a lot, guarding Chris Paul and guarding Blake Griffin. Like, yeah, that shows you the wide range of what he gives you on defense. Like, that is spectacular.
That's what they brought him in for. You know, it's for when you watch Joe Johnson carve this team up in the playoffs, you know, you think that a guy like James Johnson would be a perfect kind of remedy for that. And that's why they brought him in for his defense, which we saw yesterday. But the fact that he's also providing it on offense, you know, his shooting percentage this year, he's shooting 60%. And I think he's a career 43% shooter. So, I mean, he's just making huge strides on both ends of the floor. And, you know, I think he's going to be a valuable piece going down the stretch.
Yeah, he was 7 of 7 yesterday for his 16 points, also 2 of 2 from the line. Free throw shooting was actually a big part of yesterday's
Huge.
Game, and
yeah.
DeMar DeRozan mm-hmm. to the stripe 13 times. Mm-hmm. We knew that was a big part of his game pre-injury. It took him a little while to get back to doing that, but seems like he is once again attacking the rim. 6 of 16, you can take that when you go to the line 13 times.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the bench was a big reason why they dug themselves out of that hole, that first quarter hole. You know, Lou Williams had a nice game, and James Johnson, obviously, I think he had 12 points in the second quarter. But after that, you know, it was the stars, DeRozan, Lowry, who really kind of sustained that win for them. And you saw, like you mentioned, DeRozan's ability to get to the free throw line. It makes such a huge impact, especially against those bigger physical teams like the Clippers can be. So it was good to see, you know, it was good to see everyone back on the same page. It looked like the Raptors team, you know, save for the first quarter, it looked like the Raptors team we'd been used to seeing earlier this year, you know, moving the ball, you know, a lot of contributions from the bench and your stars contributing. Everything was coming together.
I feel like I'm having this conversation multiple times this season, but expectations for this Raptors team, they change almost week to week, I feel like, Gary. When early in the season, it was win a first-round playoff series, and then, you know, they get off to that 13-2 start. It's, oh, we'll finish first in the Eastern Conference. That's a realistic goal. That's gone out the window because the Atlanta Hawks are the 1927 Yankees all of a sudden. But now, what are expectations? Because they are still in second in the Eastern Conference, and now kind of building on that lead. It's a three-game lead mm-hmm. over the Wizards, and I know the Cavs have come on strong recently, had that, I guess, was a 12-game winning streak snapped against the Pacers of all teams. Chicago's looked kind of weak. Where do we see this team? I mean, what is an acceptable finish this regular season, Gary?
I don't think the expectations have changed much. I mean, the key for this team is they're going to be measured by what they do in the playoffs. Like, yeah. They still need to win a first round, and yeah. That's why it's paramount that they finish in the top three.
Yeah.
Because if you slide down to that 4 or 5 spot and you're getting a bad, I mean, you can still get a tough matchup in the 2-3 spot,
yeah.
But it's certainly going to be a little bit easier to do with home court advantage and, you know, playing a Charlotte or a Brooklyn or a Milwaukee. You don't want to face Chicago. You don't want to face Cleveland. Miami worries me a little bit. I think, you know, maybe not as much, Dave, but I think come playoff time, that's a team I wouldn't want the Raptors to
play. Hassan Whiteside worries me, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although they lost the T-Wolves on a hilarious play, and Hassan Whiteside's a little banged up right now. Actually, the Brooklyn Nets are in that 8 spot now by a half game over the Miami Heat.
But, you know, it's an interesting part of this stretch of the season for the Raptors because they have such a big lead in their division. They have the home court locked up. Like you mentioned, top three seed is paramount just because of the matchups. But, you know, it's going to be interesting seeing them play those potential playoff teams in the East, you know, throughout the season. We're going to be able to kind of scout the opponents, see how the different matchups work out for the Raptors. And then, you know, as the playoffs get closer, we'll have a much better idea of exactly how they could fare and who they want to avoid in terms of the jockeying for position.
All right, we've gone long enough, Dave. Every time I see you and I talk Raptors, I ask you about Jonas Valanciunas.
Valanciunas, yeah.
And his deployment in the fourth quarter. And
0 minutes last night.
Yeah, 0 minutes in the fourth. And I feel like yesterday was kind of an exception because that game was locked up kind of midway through the third quarter.
And he was struggling last night for the first game in a long time. You know, I think he was scoreless in the first half. I'm not sure how he did in the third quarter, but he was on and off. He had an off night.
But everybody's right. I mean, Jeff Blair wrote something on Sportsnet.ca recently about Valanciunas. Everybody's kind of jumped on this. Why can't he play late in the fourth quarter? And I think we all noticed in last year's playoffs as well, he was deployed a little differently. It's a different game come playoff time. You're mm-hmm. probably going to have to rely on him more. Why wait until late in the season to get that figured out? Why not, if you agree that it's all about what you do in the playoffs and maybe regular season games don't matter as much, and Dwayne Casey maybe proved it to us the other day by benching his starters in the fourth quarter, why not have Jonas Valanciunas play in crunch time?
You know, I still think it comes down to matchups, and, you know, that Brooklyn Nets team is a big team, and that's a part of the reason why it was so important to have Valanciunas on the court in the playoffs. But, you know, I was speaking to Chuck Hayes about it two days ago at the Raptors practice. And he was saying how it's just, you know, it really does come down to matchups. You know, when JV sits in the fourth quarter, Hayes tells him, you know, hey, man, you're too tall for this league. I'm too big for this league. We're going to have to wait until we play some 7-footers. And it's just kind of the reality of it right now for the Raptors. I think Casey really likes the look he gets, particularly defensively, when he has Johnson and Patterson out there. You know, they're able to kind of show on defense and help contain, you know, opposing guards when they beat their man off the dribble, which is happening more and more as of late. So I think Casey likes the mobility of those guys and what they bring defensively, and it's something that Valanciunas right now can't really bring you, especially compared to those two in particular. You know, he is slow. He does have his lapses on defense, and that down the stretch, that's the thing that really hurts a coach the most, is watching guys not able to defend.
Has he developed enough to your liking? He's still a young guy, under 25, and we know it takes big men longer to develop, mm-hmm. seemingly, in the NBA than smaller players. Has he developed enough?
You know, I think defensively he has a lot more room to grow, especially in terms of mobility on the defensive end. But I really like what I've seen from him this year. I think he's, especially the last month or so, I think he's put up some of his best, played some of his best basketball. What I really like about him is the confidence, the kind of swagger, which he's always had to a degree, but now he's going up against the top centers in the league, and he's not backing down at all. In many cases, he's being the assertive one, especially on the offensive end. And I think that's just a great sign for kind of where he is in his mind. He's put on a ton of weight, you know, a ton of muscle. It shows during games. He's really becoming a load for the other teams to handle. So I think once he tightens up those defensive lapses, you know, I think that's going to keep him on the court more, make him even a bigger part of this team going forward. And it's something, you know, I think every player gets used to it. I remember, you know, we did a profile on him in the magazine after his rookie year, and he was talking about how during that first season he was kind of blown away every time he'd play another team with a big center, because he said, you know, these guys are like animals out here, like they're not human. and now, you know, Nick Pekovic in particular, I remember him saying, was just like,
yeah, you heard that. Well, you know, I heard a story.
You hear that from a lot of guys, yeah.
Yeah. Dwight Howard said he's the strongest man on earth.
Yeah. Valanciunas said he's the strongest person he's ever had to face in his life.
And Dwight Howard's not a guy who gets pushed around easily.
So. No, he's not.
But even Pekovic aside, I mean, you know, the fact that he was kind of not in awe, but a little like taken aback by some of these opponents. I mean, you don't see that now at all. So, you know, I like that aspect of his game, the way that's coming along. His offensive game is really improving. It's just the defense you got to look at right now.
And he's progressed. I mean, Valanciunas, he's the type of guy, if he gives this team, you know, 15-10 is kind of where you want him to be. And he's not far off from those numbers. Nope. Like, he's giving them like 12-8. Nope. So if he can get to those 15-10 numbers, he's, you know, he's very valuable on this team.
Yeah, I believe leading the team in double-doubles. And mm-hmm. Jeff Van Gundy said, maybe there was a possibility he could have been an all-star, was not named to the all-star team, but yes, certainly seems to be progressing in a positive manner. And if Amir Johnson does depart this team in free agency in the offseason, might change his role going forward. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse.
But I do think, you know, it's going to be on Valanciunas to get back on the court. It doesn't matter who else is on the team. You know, if you can prove that you can move around on defense and defend space, you know, a little better than you are right now, then you'll get the minutes. I think it really is as simple as that.
I want to go back to what we were talking about, you know, booing this team in the first quarter and the feeling of sports fans in this city about the trap door about to open, the shoe about to drop. Do we believe that is something that not just permeates the fan base here in Toronto, but does that translate at all to the players, do you think, Gary? Like, when they went on that rough stretch after the Portland overtime loss and they really lost their way, with their style of play there for a week and a half. Do you think that's something that they think about in that, you know, this team doesn't really have a long history of success, and they had a great regular season last year, ended up losing in a game 7 at the final shot, blocked at the buzzer, that maybe, I hope they don't think this, but maybe Toronto sports are just cursed all the way around?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, a bit of booing last night when they're down and have a bad first quarter, I don't think such a horrible thing. I think what stands out even more is how great this fan base has been over the last, you know, year or so since, you know, it's trading Rudy Gay. I mean, you look at what they did in the playoffs, and it's not just the players in Toronto that take notice, but the rest of the league takes notice. Like, Toronto's kind of developed a reputation of kind of being a great fan base for that basketball team.
The reputation is great home court, you know, a tough home court for opponents to play on.
Yeah.
What is going on with that Clippers team, Dave? Because, yes, they get smoked in back-to-back games by Eastern Conference opponents, the better teams in the Eastern Conference.
And before that, they lost to the Nets as well.
Yeah, they lost to the Nets. They've lost the Wizards at home this season as well, and they take so many technical fouls.
Yeah.
They're teed up again yesterday, and they took, I believe it was three techs in 4 minutes in that game against the Cavaliers. It really seems like something's not right there. We know their bench isn't all that great.
Yeah.
Seems like chemistry might be an issue with them, though.
Well, it's weird, you know, and it goes back to what we were talking about the Leafs. You know, it all starts with your leadership. It all starts at the top. And with Chris Paul, I mean, he's maybe the most talented point guard in the NBA, but more and more, it seems, I mean, and he's been doing this for a long time, he's got this petulant kind of baby act where he's just always complaining about something, always whining. I know nobody in the NBA thinks they've ever actually committed a foul, but I mean, he just takes it to another level. And I mean, it's hard to imagine that doesn't seep through the rest of the players in some way. Maybe it's frustration with Paul. Maybe they just feed off it and then they go off on their own thing. You know, Blake Griffin's another guy who has a lot of issues with referees and other players. So yeah, it's a really talented team, but maybe there's kind of an attitude issue with them. But they're a little bipolar. I mean, sometimes you see them play and you think like this is a great NBA right. team. They're going to go to the finals, whatever.
But I believe they've beaten Golden State this year.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. They have the horses to compete against those top teams. But then you see this week the way they come out and just kind of shoot themselves in the foot and allow themselves to give up big leads, to get blown out by I don't know about inferior teams, but get blown out by Eastern Conference teams. And that's not where they want to be, obviously. So I think, you know, I don't know, because Chris Paul is an incredibly valuable player. But at what point is he detracting from your team? I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like there are some things that can't be measured with statistics that aren't exactly going right for this Clippers team right now. It is funny, though. The Clippers now drop a game back of the Raptors in the overall NBA standings at 33-18. So that would have them third in the Eastern Conference. They're sixth in the West right now. The Phoenix Suns holding down that eight spot in the West at 29-23. But that's only by one game over the New Orleans Pelicans, who came up with a last-second spectacular
win. Did you see that game last night?
Yes.
Did you see that Anthony Davis shot, that three-pointer?
Yes.
That was insane. I mean, for a guy to be 7 feet tall and just hang in the air like that and wait for the defender to kind of move out of the way and then still release the shot, I mean, that was one of the kind of all-time great games. For this season, that was one of the best games
yesterday
I can remember.
Was one of the best NBA regular season days
I can
remember in a long time, because you had the Hawks and Warriors as well playing. But it opens up this big question, and Gary, I'll start with you, about Adam Silver talking about, you know what, playoff restructuring is a thing we've talked about. It's a thing that might happen in the future where his proposal, or at least the proposal he was talking about, is your division winners get the top six seeds in whatever order, and then you fill out the bottom 10 with whoever has the best record outside of those division winners. I mean, the last couple of years, we've seen some embarrassing, you know, sub 500 teams make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference. This just makes sense to you?
It does. I mean, I like the idea of going 1-16. I'm kind of a little cold on the idea of giving the division winners the top six, because you still have a potential of having a bad team sneak into that top six. I mean, you look at the Titanic division of a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been horrible if one of those teams would, you know, get ahead of a Western Conference team again. So I'm a big fan of going 1-16. But in that case, you would need to find a better balance in schedule. You can't have it as heavily divisional play and conference play and expect to go 1-16. So it's an interesting concept. But I think it's a great thing that Silver is talking about this and they're looking into it and they're doing the proper research and seeing what the benefits are.
And that's what you know you're going to get with Silver. I mean, he's a proactive commissioner. You know, he's been very, very open about the fact that, like, there's a huge chance you're going to see logos on jerseys, things like that. So I think, you know, this is just another thing. He's not afraid to look at new ideas, to explore them. So I wouldn't be surprised if we did see this. I think it would be a bit of a shock to the system at first, but I mean, I think the teams in the West have to be rewarded. You know, if you're playing really good basketball, you should be rewarded for that. If you're playing losing basketball, you should not be. I think it's as simple as that.
Well, the thing is, I mean, the Oklahoma City Thunder, if they get into the playoffs, and they are just three games back, but it's concerning because you lose to a team directly in front of you yesterday. They still have to play, you know, the Western Conference, where no night is an easy night. And they got off to such a slow start without Westbrook or Durant. Mm-hmm. But if that team gets in, right, like they can win it all.
That's one team, if they get in, and that's becoming a bigger if than I thought it would be. But if they get in, you know, that's, I would never want to face them. You know, I could see them making a huge run just because of the talent of those two guys. They're not playing well right now as a team. They're playing really kind of selfishly. But
they kind of got a Clippers thing going on there with chemistry, right?
Yes, yeah, they do. There's some bad vibes coming out of that locker room. But that being said, we've seen them make that finals run. We know how good they can be. Westbrook is playing some unbelievable basketball this season. Durant is still Durant. You know, there's a big drop off after that, especially after Ibaka. But that's a team that still scares me. You know, even if they're out of a playoff spot, I'm still scared of them.
Yeah, you think the Golden State Warriors are relishing a first round matchup with them?
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe it could be a goose. What's good for the goose is good for the gander for the Warriors after they knocked off the number one seed Dallas Mavericks a couple of years ago. Yeah. If they're knocked off by an 8 seed in the opening round of the playoffs this year. I have to see, though. It seems like every single matchup in the West come playoff time is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. As it was last year.
Yep, absolutely.
If you're the Toronto Raptors, you're probably happy they don't go 1-16 for this playoff format this year. Because just looking at the overall standings now, they would face the Chicago Bulls in the first round if you went 1-16.
Oh, great. So.
But we also would get a great first round matchup between the Clippers and Spurs. So
yeah, that would be that'd be interesting. Who knows if the Spurs are finally hitting that age barrier? But I'm not going to doubt Greg Popovich until you know he actually ends up flaming out. When we come back. Toronto FC making news, and no, they don't have a slogan yet. No bloody big deal. No marketing angle. But Gary, I'm sure they're trying to think of something, right? Or maybe they're not. Maybe they're just shying away from that entirely.
Yeah, that didn't end so well last time.
No. So no bloody big deal. But the Atomic Ant has arrived in this city. Sebastian Jovinka. We'll talk about him and his prospects in this city. Also, are we excited about a Manny Pacquiao Floyd Mayweather matchup? Is that a pay-per-view you would buy? I've never bought a boxing pay-per-view, but I feel like I might actually do a little purchase on that. Also, any chance you got to talk about Tinder, we will take that chance. We will take that opportunity. And there is a connection to Julian Edelman and Tinder. And maybe we'll even talk about the Madrid Derby as well. All that and more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Dave Zarum. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Dave Zarum and Gary Mello. Just looking at the MLS standings, they have not played a game yet, and training camp has just begun. But I guess it's just alphabetical. But Toronto FC is dead last at the standings I'm looking at.
A bit of foreshadowing, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe it's been a lousy almost decade for Toronto FC. They've yet to make the playoffs in their 8-year history, which is difficult to do because you know, first of all, a lot of teams make the playoffs in Major League Soccer, and it's easy. Not easy, but it does happen quite often that you go worst to first or, you know, worst to into the playoffs at least. And they've never been there despite all their best efforts, despite landing maybe the greatest player. You know, this is including David Beckham, the greatest active player to play in the league. I think Jermaine Defoe is probably in that conversation. They had him last year and health played a factor. He didn't play nearly as much as they would have liked. But when he did play, he was good. They still missed the playoffs. Now it's up to the Atomic Ant, Sebastian Jovinko. He arrived in Toronto this week. 400 people at the airport for him on Thursday. He addressed the media with an interpreter yesterday, and I don't know too much about him. I know he's a short guy. He's a playmaker. He's you know in his mid to late 20s, and he's got some national team looks for the Italian national side. This just appears to be all about money. Looks like a guy who's almost, Gary, like in his prime and going to play in Major League Soccer.
No doubt. I mean, it's easy to say with the benefit of hindsight and seeing how the Defoe thing played out. But I think Jovinko will probably slot into this team a little more and probably bring a little bit more to them. I think one thing that really hurt Defoe, too, is he was out. He missed a lot of games for a while. So if Jovinko can be a regular in this lineup and help, you know, in that build-up play and help that offense move forward, they still have some serious issues defensively. But if there's any team that needs success on the field, I mean, it's TFC. I mean, it's been year after year of disappointment. And you know, you mentioned the standings this year. Like, you got 10 teams in the Eastern Conference. Two of them are franchise, you know, expansion franchises. If you can't make the playoffs this year, then I don't know what else you need to do. Like,
it looks like TFC could make the playoffs this year because they changed the rules to allow two more teams in the playoffs, right?
Right. Like, I mean, you know, six teams will make it in of those 10, and two of them are expansion franchises. So you essentially need to be better than, you know, you hope you're going to be better than those two expansion franchises. So you got to be better than two other teams. So, I mean, that's a pretty low bar.
You've got a lot of named players now on this team. Michael Bradley, Josie Altidore on this team as well. And now Sebastian Giovinco. It's not always about the name players, but I mean, you look on paper, I mean, that should be a good enough team. And it's hard, I find, to criticize the front office for their moves, at least the last couple of years with this team. Now, maybe you can criticize what they've done with the managers, and the Ryan Nelson thing was definitely a head scratcher with no experience. He's gone. But as far as getting the supporters of this club excited and going out and grabbing the biggest names out there, Gary, I mean, they've done a pretty good job of that.
I mean, they've done a good job of bringing in the big names the last couple of years, at least. And, you know, you get the fans excited with the Bradley, and you mentioned the Defoe and the Altidore and such. But they haven't addressed issues, like, defensively. Like, I'm still not convinced this team is where they need to be defensively to compete for a playoff spot. I mean, you got Caldwell, who could potentially be the captain. But, you know, with the systems they've played and the players they've employed in the back line, they haven't been able to shut it down enough. And I think that's an area they need to address.
And it's going to be a tough start for Toronto FC because of the improvements to BMO Field that we can all see driving down the Gardner there. They start with a whole bunch of road games. In fact, they've got seven of them to start the Major League Soccer season. So hopefully they'll be able to figure that out before they return home on May 10th.
Can I ask, I'm going to do it anyways. What do we think of Josie Altidore?
Well, he's a guy who is not unfamiliar with this game, right, Gary? But did not have all that much success in the Premier League.
No, he didn't. I mean, he started off as a really, you know, a very high prospect in Major League Soccer. Went over to Europe, and like a lot of players that go from the MLS over to Europe kind of struggle a little bit. You know, guys like Freddie Montero, for example, you know, he was a really, you know, sharp player with Seattle for a while,
pretty good in the Dutch league, though.
Yeah, and I mean, like, he had a good start. He started in the Portuguese league last season, got off to a great start, and then I don't think scored a goal for, like, the second half of the season. So, I mean, you know, he's not alone, Josie Altidore, in struggling and, you know, trying to adapt to that European game. So it's interesting if he can come back to the MLS and do what he did early on in his career.
Yeah, because I just remember, like, I mean, the hype when he went over to England,
right,
how this was, like, the greatest American player that we're going to see over there. But didn't he struggle in international competition as well for America?
He looked
America?
Good before he got hurt in the World Cup, right?
Yeah, he did. I mean, it was with the U.S. too, right? So the bar is also a little low. I mean, they've been a good team, but, you know, he hasn't been fantastic for them.
Are they going to be banking a lot on his production this year?
On Josie? I think they need to. I mean, they're going to need someone to bag some goals. So, I mean, your midfield is a little bit more solid now. So if Josie Altidore can, you know, kind of bring that game in the final third, then, you know, of the field, then I think they'll be in a much better shape than what they were last year.
Yeah, they are kind of turned into de facto, I guess, Team USA in Major League Soccer. One of the three Canadian franchises. We talked about it before we went to break there. Boxing is kind of off of everybody's radar, and it has been for the last few years, right? There's not too many fights that we get really jacked up about. Mike Tyson has retired a long time ago. Evander Holyfield, yes. He fought deep into his 40s, believe into his 50s as well, but it looks like his career is finally over. But boxing has once again kind of been rekindled, at least the conversation has, because it does seem, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but it seems like every day there's a progression between talks between Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather about this fight actually happening. Now, it's not, you know, vintage Manny Pacquiao or vintage Floyd Mayweather. But, I mean, those names alone, Dave, I mean, does that get you intrigued? Does that have you, you know, thinking about the possibility of having your buds over and buying that pay-per-view?
It does. I mean, this would be the first pay-per-view that I would have bought since Lennox Lewis and Mike Tyson. And so it's been a while. But, you know, I think when you look at, yeah, it is a little late for these guys, because how long have we've been talking about wanting to see these two, the best fighters around, face each other? You know, the term pound for pound, I mean, that carries a lot of weight in boxing, obviously, because that's what it's all about, settling. You know, few sports can you really settle who's better than in a straight-up fight. So I think everyone's wanted to see this for so long. The fact that it's around the corner is just huge for boxing. You know, you can just, I can't even imagine what the numbers would be for a pay-per-view for something like that.
And boxing needs this. I mean, best case scenario, you're going to get a trilogy out of this. I mean, they're a little long in the tooth. I mean, I think Mayweather's 37, Pacquiao's 36. So it's a little tough to kind of squeeze in that trilogy. But
I think if this happens, it will be a trilogy for sure. I think that money's going to be too great to turn down. I mean, they're already talking about splitting $100+ million purse for the first fight. You can only imagine what the second fight would get. And then the third fight, you know, the rubber match, assuming it goes that way. So I think if this does happen, it will be a trilogy that these guys end their careers on.
I think the one interesting part of this discussion, too, is the timing of it. I mean, boxing, you know, they haven't had much to celebrate in the last couple of years. And, you know, credit to the UFC, they've been able to kind of take that kind of that fight audience, right? And UFC's coming off a very tough 2014. It hasn't been a good start to this year with, you know, with Diaz and Silva, failing drug tests after the last UFC pay-per-view. So it's interesting that kind of boxing is stealing a bit of the spotlight. So, I mean, they need to milk it.
Yeah,
the
UFC hasn't seemed this week in a really long time, you know, as long as I can remember. Since it became popular. So yeah, this is the time where if you're boxing, you really want to pounce on that, kick them while they're down, so to speak, and really try to help elevate your game. But the problem is, you know, we were talking about in the break, what's the future then? You know, after this trilogy, who's the next guy to come in and captivate boxing audiences or fight fans in general? And, you know, that's the big issue in boxing right now, is who's going to take that mantle? Because in UFC, while it may be in a downturn, it seems there's a pretty steady rotation of guys always coming through that we don't see in the same way in boxing.
I'm among those that says, you know, boxing is dead. It's not what it once was, but it's hard to look at a $2 million super fight and say, boxing's dead.
You know, I think the heavyweight division is dead comparatively.
For now,
I don't know
I
about
guess.
Boxing in general.
Unless those Klitschko's getting a war with each other, which is never happening.
It's like the Pacquiao Mayweather. You know, it's another one we wanted to see for so long. Could you imagine the viewership, you know, the hype if those two were to fight? You know, it's a similar situation.
I hope they give their parents seats ringside at least for that one.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Their mother will not let that one take place. But yeah. I'd be buying that one. I don't know. Boxing to me is, I have a difficult time necessarily understanding the sweet science. De La Hoya, Mayweather, I know a lot of people talk about that being one of the greatest fights in the last decade or so. I watched that here at Sportsnet. I think it was. I didn't pay for it. But I don't know. It was tough to get into. And maybe it is the fact that they were, you know, not heavyweights, and there weren't the big blows being thrown, and never looked like it was ever going to be a knockout.
You know, I can't claim to be the biggest boxing fan, but I do think, you know, you don't get a sense of theater in other sports like you do in a great boxing match.
That's
you know?
True.
It really is. I mean, it's really compelling. You even think back, I mean, I wasn't alive for it, but you know, like did you ever see the documentary When We Were Kings about the Ali former Rumble in the Jungle? I mean, just the amount of tension in there, the amount of drama in there, I mean, and the fact that it's settled with your fists in the middle of a ring, I just think, you know, other sports can't match the drama of that. So I want to see, you know, as a sports fan, I want to see boxing elevated to where it once was. I just don't know if we're going to get there.
I would love to go see one of these matchups in person. I would love to go to the MGM Grand and check that out. That would be unbelievable. Chris Paul, getting back to basketball for just a second, has been fined $25,000 for his public criticism of female referee Lauren Holtkamp. It looked like those were some pretty questionable-ish calls. We know that the Clippers do have a reputation as far as being kind of petulant and arguing after seemingly every single call. There were calls that maybe Chris Paul had some sort of sexual connotation as far as gender in criticizing the referee, saying maybe this isn't for her. I don't know if I necessarily saw it the same way. I just saw it as a general criticism of a referee.
Well, you know, like the refereeing is always a question mark in general. And in the NBA, it seems like it's getting progressively a little worse and worse. And we are seeing all these kind of questionable calls and whatnot. But, you know, for him to say, you know, maybe this isn't for her, you know, I think it's definitely fine worthy. I think even to hint at that kind of misogynistic stuff is just, it's just not cool. There's no place for that. So, you know, I expected him to get penalized, and I'm not surprised to hear that he was.
I mean, the one little wrinkle in this, I find in Holtkamp, she is a first-year official. So
yeah.
I'm curious
yeah,
to know how many first-year officials get that kind of flack, regardless of the gender. Like, would a Chris Paul said that to a first-year male official? I would think so. Like, I'd like to hope this wasn't, you know, gender-specific for the reasons he made the comment. It sounds a little worse because he had, you know, you put the word her at the end of the sentence. So it makes it seem like, you know, he's criticizing a female official. So I'd like to hope that wasn't the case. But either way, I mean, I think the fine is pretty justified.
Fair enough. And if you go courtside, sit on a court for an NBA game, I mean, yeah, the teams are trash talking to each other, but the amount of vitriol that is directed towards the referees is just like unbelievable.
Right.
And it is probably the most difficult professional sport to officiate. Block charge is so difficult.
And so, I mean, it's one of the reasons why they brought in the replay, which I think is more a nuisance than anything else, although it does settle things like the block charge debate.
Moving on. This is the biggest story we're going to talk about all day, I imagine. Julian Edelman, after the New England Patriots parade, hooked up with a woman in Boston, and she ends up posting a picture on Tinder of Edelman in the background of the photo. I made a comment like, yes, I just slept with Julian Edelman. What do we think of this?
I think it's a faux pas.
Can't be doing that. Listen, you're the only single guy in the room here, Dave. So we're going to lean on you for information as far as online dating and what the rules are and what the faux pas are and aren't.
I can't claim to have much experience in the online dating world. You know, I just got a smartphone for the first time like a few months ago, so I'm a little behind with all that kind of stuff.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Were you using like Motorola Razr or something?
Yeah, no, I was using my beeper.
Your pager.
Beepers? Pager, that's the word.
They still make those?
You can find them. If you look hard enough. But so what really interests me about the Julian Edelman Tinder thing was I was just thinking like, in history, because of the internet age and everything that's available now, in history, how many athletes would have been getting this kind of stuff? Like, I was just thinking of Wilt Chamberlain. Like, could you imagine Wilt Chamberlain was in his prime in the Tinder age and the social media age? Yeah. How kind of relentless this stuff would be?
It seems like the Super Bowl is far in our rearview mirror, but there are still some lingering things we can talk about as far as the game and the aftermath of it. I love watching the celebration footage, and Rob Gronkowski, I think, is kind of him, and I guess Edelman, you could say, is kind of been front and foremost in the celebration. But Gronkowski grabbing the beers, chugging them. Hey, he's made the rounds on all the late night talk shows and everything.
He's been great. I mean, he's a lot of fun. You know, I think when you look at that video, I kind of broke it down like the Zapp Ruder film. I think for a while there, he's asking permission, like from a PR guy or someone. He's saying, you know, that guy's got a beer. Can I drink it? Can I drink that? And the guy just kind of says, yeah, sure, whatever. And then he goes, he grabs it, and obviously we know what happened. It's just fun. You know, you love to see these guys' personalities so much. So often, rather, it seems that they're penalized for showing personality.
You think people would love it as much if it was Richard Sherman doing that?
It's interesting. Winning, I feel like, takes care of a lot of that, though.
Yeah, true enough.
Yeah, and Richard Sherman, yes, he got the rap as the you know guy who was disrespectful after that playoff game and the Aaron Andrews interview last year, but then won a Super Bowl. That kind of all went away.
You know, also, I don't want to go do too deep into it, but I did find the other part of me thought, you know, when we see this guy chugging the beer and how much we're celebrating it, I couldn't help but think, you know, with the way drugs and whatnot are enforced in pro sports, you know, he's being celebrated for that. But if replace the can of beer with something else, something like an innocent recreational drug.
What if it was the Denver Broncos won the Super Bowl and
exactly.
They were doing, you know,
he'd be
partaking.
He'd be kicked off the team. He'd be suspended. You know, he'd be whatever. He'd be in jail. But he's chugging a beer and we all love it.
Yeah, and Josh Gordon is going to sit out the entire season for drinking a beer, although it's a different scenario.
That seems, it's more of a compounding issues kind of thing, right?
Before we go, Pete Carroll, yes, it's been done to death as far as looking at the call to throw that ball.
Hey, do you think he should have ran it there or what?
We're not getting into that discussion, but I want to discuss in the final 60 seconds we have here, his handling of the situation and his accepting the quote-unquote blame, if you want to call it blame. Seems like he's really done just about as well as you could considering the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the one interesting thing for me with the Seahawks, honestly, we talked about that, you know, the play itself has been discussed to death. I think what's interesting now is what happens to this team moving forward. Yeah. I mean, here's a team, they win the Super Bowl, you're probably talking dynasty, you know, having back-to-back Super Bowls. Now it's like, can his players respect him and can they trust him the same after that play?
And they just lost their defensive coordinator, right?
Yep.
Now the coach in Atlanta.
Yeah, it's very difficult to repeat as Super Bowl champions and very difficult to stay on top when you are at the top and some question marks surrounding Marshawn Lynch. And now they got to pay Russell Wilson as well.
But yeah, to what you're saying here, I mean, I think it goes one of two ways. They either rally around him and say, you know, whatever, this is our guy, you know, he's taking us here, we're going to go continue with him forward, or they turn on him. I think it's, you know, it's going to be one extreme in either direction.
Interesting to see which way it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's got them a Super Bowl ring, so not going to be able to take that away from. All right, that'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today coming up next. Mike Wilner going to join me. We'll talk a little more baseball coming up. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.